Hey, Spittin' Chiclets listeners, you can find every episode on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 295 of Spittin' Chiclets, presented by Pink Whitney, for my friends at New Amsterdam Vodka, here in the Barstool Sports Podcast family. This is also the last episode we're doing on this junket to Boston biz. You've been here for 3+ weeks now.
Yeah, years.
Yeah, like I called the last episode, MCI Charlestown. How was your time here? This is basically our last night here.
It was good, man. It was a little funky being out of my routine in Phoenix, given we've been quarantined for so long. But, it was great getting together with you guys. Shared a lot of laughs, especially on the golf course, on the boat trip. Well, not so many laughs for me on the boat trip. But, we got a lot of things accomplished. We had some funny clips. The Warthog from the
Biz.
The electric chairs, which went viral. So, yeah, it's been a good time, man. It was good seeing you guys. You know I love you, and it's great when we're together.
For people who are wondering, when Biz talks about he's out of his routine, he's been to the same place every single morning to get the same exact breakfast sandwich. He then goes and does the exact same thing in his room, throws himself around it, and then orders the exact same thing from dinner every single night. I go, dude, are you not sick of that place? No, man, I'm a creature of habit. I'm like, I am too, but not the same meal every single day. So I understand you're going crazy, but you've kind of put yourself in a big time, like, mini bubble right around this house.
Yes, correct. Yeah, I'm.
Biz doesn't understand that it's in Scottsdale, he doesn't really get recognized everywhere all the time.
Never.
Here, he gets a little bit, everyone sees who he is, and then, like, dude, it can be a little overwhelming.
Well, I get the social anxiety gets popping a little bit where I'm like I just smoked a fat one, and now you're coming up saying hi to me.
Well, are coming up, and they don't know if you smoked fat one or possibly you're microdosing. It's
that's
like,
true.
What Biz am I going to get? And the funny thing is, I think I'm the one guy, maybe Grinnelli and RA as well, that could be like, oh, he's on that right now.
Yeah. Yeah, so 100%. I kind of just ride the wave. And another thing, too, is it was great getting to know our videographer, our new one, Chase. Came over from Seattle, and then 8 days after he was in NYC, this all happened. So this is the first time we've been able to get together. He helped us film 3 sandbaggers. He did the boat video. He's going to be editing all that. So we're adding to our team as well.
And he can chuck lefts.
And he, I don't know if you guys saw the YouTube
video. We chirped
video.
Him first appearance on the show, but then all of a sudden a video comes out of what he would do to me on the ice. Now I can't chirp the guy anymore. So respect to Chase. Nice getting to know you.
Correct. He's a videographer and team security as well.
Yeah, exactly.
From now on. So we've added another member, and fucking rights, Chaser. Stick taps, boys.
Yeah.
Not too many.
Three weeks in this house with us is definitely baptism by, like, a 5-alarm fire, not just baptism by fire, because it's a lot to, like, live with 3 fucking strangers, essentially.
Well, I didn't know RA was moving.
Yeah, RA, guys, let's get this. RA lives 0.9 miles from here and has slept here for 20 days. So the fact that you're like, I didn't realize how crazy it would be, like, you could go home.
RA, you could just tell me you love me back.
Yeah.
Instead of just, like, making it that obvious.
Yeah.
You
hey,
want to
man,
be around
was,
me the entire
know,
time.
A little break. Hey, don't forget. Yeah, we've all been under pandemic orders here in Mass, too. I've been basically cooped up as well, so it was a little bit of a respite for myself as well. All due respect to my old lady. I love her, but,
yeah.
You know, I'm sure she did. I'm sure
just
she
a little alone time.
Yeah, I'm sure she didn't. She didn't miss me all that much either. Biz, I was legit getting texts like every other day. I think I just saw Biz down CVS. I think I just saw Biz here. I'm like, yeah, you probably did.
Just the breakfast bagel place.
Yeah, that's about it.
No, but did we say how you were? Did I already mention how you mentioned, like, people in Boston are just miserable? Did I say that on another show?
Yeah.
So Biz is like, first day I say, or maybe I was like, second or third day I came, you're like, dude, people are miserable here. I'm like, yeah, what do you have you seen how I live how I act, Biz? I'm like, what do you mean, though? He said, well, I go into Starbucks, and I'm usually just like, hey, how you doing, man? And people are just giving you the death sticks around here. It's like, don't say a
They're
word
spitting
to me.
In my nitro brew because I fucking asked
you
for
said
a little.
Hello.
Yeah, because I said hi, for crying out loud. They give you the death stare. And I'll tell you what, after they were rude, I gave him a bit of a stare down, but I was so focused on the stare down, I'd actually forgotten my phone there.
Oh, so, hey, walk of shame.
So, hey, I'm talking like the look back where I'm staring this lady down for being a complete B-I-T-C-H to me. And I'm kind of like, geez, like I'm being friendly. Like, why are you so miserable? So I made
your breath was probably kicking. Oh, no, you got a mask on.
So I was too embarrassed to go back in when I forgot my phone. I made Grinnelli go in.
No, you should have been like, no, you have to eat that.
She knew right away, too. Right when I walked in, she's like, got your phone. Here you go, douchebag.
Yeah. Why? I was like my Curb You Enthusiasm moment where I was staring her down.
No, people are better than you give them credit for, though, Biz. People are happy around here. It's not like Scottsdale.
You're going to see a video on Twitter. I'm just hopping the counter in a fucking Starbucks going toe-to-toe with somebody.
Because he didn't say hi to you, like, loudly enough back.
Yeah.
Hey. You whispered hello.
Uncle Gigi.
I
want to
see teeth, motherfucker.
He thought you lost your kid. My Uncle Gigi was here. He's like, where'd he lose his kid or something? Like, no, he just forgot his phone at Starbucks. He legit thought you lost.
Yeah,
I mean, I know
that's
phones
my
are
lifeline,
but,
man.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You did mention the fishing trip, so probably a good time to mention our guest we'll be bringing on a little later, Todd Fedoruk.
Yeah.
Played over 500 games in the NHL, mostly with the Philadelphia Flyers.
What a great interview that was.
It was raw.
Yeah, it was very raw. I had never met Todd, and we had a blast. The painting was a gift, Todd. And I just actually loved being around him. When he came in, right when I met him, I'm like, this guy is...
He comes in hot.
He came in hot. He came down the stairs of this house, guys. So I show up, and I'm just sitting there, and I'm like, "Where?" Donnie Does was here.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, shooting the shit, and all of a sudden I hear a thud. And he's like, ah! I'm like, what the fuck is going on? It's Fedoruk. He's like, I hit my head again. Fuck. I was like, whoa, we're about to interview this guy. But we got down to his career, his life, and a lot of things that I think people will really enjoy. That was a lot of fun.
He was a tough SOB, guys. This guy could chuck him, and he had a nasty injury that he talks about. And, another guy with a great message. And,
waking up to him six. It was like 7:15. I was sleeping right there. The door's 2 feet away. Bang on the door. Now I didn't know he was coming here. I opened. I'm like, who are you? He's like, what's up, man? I'm Todd. I was expecting Donnie Does. Legit thought like I was getting home invaded for about 30 seconds. I was like, oh, fridge. Yeah, come on in. Fucking make yourself at home. Scared the shit out of me.
Very. Did you chuck your hat on before you entered the door?
I might have put a blanket on top. So just didn't know. I didn't know if I was gonna get Pearl Harbored by one of these guys again.
What's Pearl Harbored mean?
Being surprised out of the blue.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, like video bombed.
All right, yeah, maybe. Yeah, we,
exactly. Didn't know what was going on. Well, anyways, Whitney got
his wish. Over my head.
Not the first time. Won't be the last.
Well, I know, but it was more of a play on the.
It's
the joke. The
it's
original
actually,
joke.
Like, you know, right?
Pearl Harbor joke.
They used to use it in wrestling.
So I guess you're not so smart after all. All right?
I think you just flipped it.
I flipped the script on you.
Nah, it went over my head.
All right, well.
Now we're on the same page, I guess.
Nothing ever goes over my head.
We're not making light of that situation.
You've never gotten shit over my head on this podcast.
Honestly, I know it's a phrase people don't. It's an old wrestling phrase they used to use on the old WWF, fucking Pearl Harbor, as a verb, yeah.
Remind me to tell you the funny Wingfoot story where the U.S. Open is this week.
Well, I kind of want to hear it now.
No. We got to get to some
golf.
Okay,
we
got to
save the golf talk.
And like I just said, Whit got his wish. He's got at least one more New York Islanders game this season. Tuesday night, Isles win 2-1 in a double overtime game to force game 6. Again, I know it's funny to say a double overtime game, not the most thrilling, but the Islanders, I think they had like 20 shots after regulation. Just a grind of a battle. But then fucking your boy, Jordan Eberle, I don't know how he gets that open in overtime.
What do you mean how does he get that open? Because fucking our boy Shaddy whiffed one at the point.
Yep, tough bounce. And Shaddy's played great.
Shaddy's played awesome.
That's something that it's just shit luck, man. We talked about, I think we were doing the behind the scenes or something when we were just talking to Chaser about the cup just being, it's like all luck. It's really crazy to see, and we'll go into the other series, but last night, that's just a bad break. There is not one thing a coach could be mad at Shattenkirk for on that play. And now you got to give credit because Lee made a sick play to just kick it off the wall to himself, step around him, and then the great pass. And Eberle, man, he's really as clutch as they come as a player. You go back to the World Junior heroics that he continually pulled, I think 2 years in a row with Canada. He scores this fucking highlight reel insane goal, his first game as an Oiler. I was on the bench for that one, but I think I picked up a couple apples.
Plus.
That
you probably went
I had two apples first game
plus.
Of that year, thank you. And he's just been a really good player. It's funny, I called that he wasn't going to resign there. Thanks, Ebs. And then he ended up being there, and he loves it. And so I'm happy for him. Now, I'm going to let you go into the game because I got some stats after to make sure that the Tampa Bay Lightning fans aren't going to They don't have to worry.
So before the game, Johnny Boychuk, it was announced that he would be playing, right? So
what a start.
So I'm like, fucking right. It's like you know, this guy's back in. That's a big bounce for that lineup. And, like, you know, when you just lost the last game, you're down 3-1, getting an injection like that type of guy, I think it helps the room out. Helps the morale a little bit. You know, stay clicks, boys.
Not too many. We just did.
And, like, early on, blocks a shot, gets it right in the gut. And I'm thinking, I know that feeling when, you know, you're coming off an injury or you're maybe even still injured and you decide to play and you're like, hey, I'm just hoping this kind of goes one of those games where, you know, I don't get dinged up at all. Nice free-flowing game. No. Eats one right in the fucking belly button. So
Yeah, but it's playoffs. You almost want that. That's how you're going to get into it. I don't think he, like, hated that part. He's like, fuck, but, you know, you're in it.
Right. So then I think, like, two or three shifts later, he ends up fucking taking a clapper right off his boot and it breaks his skate blade. So he's fucking sitting around in the middle of the ice, trying to, like, you know, scoot himself off. So I'm
trying
thinking,
to C-cut to
this
the
guy
bench.
Just got back, you know, that type of grinder type, and he's got to put up with that in the first period. But he looked like he fit right in after that. Tough bounce off the start. But Varlamov, he had a funny clip after the game, diving into the pile. You know, he had a great bounce back game. I mean, he's been fairly solid this series. Given what he dealt with, I mean, 37 shots from Tampa last game. I thought that they controlled the play, and I thought Tampa deserved to win. But that's fucking how the Islanders roll. Another thing, they end up tying up the game 1-1, and then they should have gone ahead, Tampa. But this is why I'm okay with the rule existing. And I don't know how the fucking refs missed this one. Paquette was offside by, I think, 20 feet. Like, it was a Kreider offside.
Yeah, 20 feet's being, like, generous. Could have been 30.
Yeah, it might have been.
It was the most obvious offside. Ryder was like, offside, offside.
And he can't talk yet.
No, he just, like, knew offside. Those were his first words. Like, that's how he learned it, by seeing how offside Paquette was.
Yes. That tells you how much this fucking
It's so guy. Interesting to see how, like, they'd miss that. So,
well, they but, did. And that's one of those situations where it's like,
too obvious.
I don't necessarily like the rule, because I do feel like it slows down play, and, like, in most cases the guy's skate's hovering over it, or it's like a millimeter or an inch.
Okay, how about my idea then for something like that? League buzzes down, the guy gets on the horn, the ref, he goes, they just go no goal, and you don't even spend 1 second, or they can even, like, announce in the arena no goal.
But then
Toronto,
you're gonna have
it's that quick.
You're gonna have to have constantly guys looking over video.
They already do. Like last night, like, I'm saying, once they review it, right, just be like, don't make them go to the video or anything. Just, like, that obvious, the lead just calls down. It's not a goal.
I thought, like, I mean, in some cases, what if there's, like, a minute and a half sustained pressure? Like, you're going to have to just, like, wait to rewind the tape. And, like, you got to get all that done.
I think they have people that are, like, I think people are watching it live. And they got other guys that they're stopping and watching replays.
Here's why I'm on board with it. If they don't have enough people to do it now, they should. And they can hire people and create more jobs. So, genius idea, Whit. Genius fucking idea. So that negates the goal 1-1, and then it ends up going into two OTs. So credit the Islanders. And I got a feeling.
So you're feeling.
But here's another thing. Point doesn't play in game five.
That's
fuck,
a worry.
Dude. What's going on with Point? They got no Stamkos. They got no Point. That's two of their best three forwards out of the fucking lineup. And then, we're not going to get into Dallas yet, but Jesus Christ, they just keep getting some decent bounces.
Listen. I personally, this is just me throwing it out there. I think that Point's banged up. He was questionable in game four. He played. He had a huge goal.
Yeah.
Right? I think it's like, we're up 3-1. Let's not play you tonight.
Get you the rest.
You get a little extra rest. We're going to try to close him out tonight without you. And then, you know, you get a couple extra days. And then they're also thinking, we got two more games to do it. So I'm very surprised. If he's not in next game, then you start thinking he could be out for long term. If he doesn't play game six, you are in one.
Correct. And in an unusual case, and given it's in the bubble, and you assume that the players and everybody inside there wants to go home, is if they were to close out in game five, they would have been starting up on Thursday. I guess we're in Thursday now, because that's when you guys are listening to it. So they're thinking, whoa, mind trip, bro.
What the fuck did you just say, man?
Yo, pass the J, bro. Fuck, now I lost my train of thought.
I knew you would. That's exactly why I did it. You were talking about how tonight was going to be the start of the Stanley
Cup
final.
So they're probably thinking, hey, if we're able to close out in five, at least we get him the couple extra days, depending on what it is. So, but like you said, now that it's going to six, if we don't see point again, you're thinking, okay, did he aggravate something, then try to come back too soon and then re-aggravate it? Like, this is a guy, given with what Dallas has thrown at teams and how they're able to just keep finding ways to win, if you're Dallas, you're probably a lot less confident not having Point and not having Stamkos in lineup. Although, Stamkos started practicing with the team, I believe. So there's a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, but the since 2000, right, when the Flyers did it, every single team that's been up 3-1 in the conference finals has closed the series out. They've ended it. It's 16 times in a row. So
ended it in five?
No, just won the series. So I'm saying you got two more games. If Point's out, yeah, you start like thinking like it could happen. They got Vasilevsky. Kucherov is playing so well. Yeah. Kucherov, his game is so sick.
Fuck, he got hurt the other night. I know. There was a bit of a scare.
And he's just a snap show, too, out there, which we've mentioned a bunch of times. So Tampa Bay's never – they've never lost a series when they held a 3-1 lead. And granted, you could say, well, at some point it's going to happen. It's not going to happen this year. And part of the reason is Vasilevsky. I mean, they lost last night. How good was he still?
Yeah, he was awesome. It's
Tampa, Dallas. It's going to be glorious. When the Islanders lose, but at least we get a little bit more excitement in a game six.
What was one other thing?
All right, what do you got on the series?
Basically, I was going to add like Stamkos was spotted practicing, shooting around. I don't know how close he is to returning. Once again, Varlamov. What did you say, Biz? 30? I got it written down. 30.
I think he had 36 saves.
Yeah, he had a great night again. Boys, you guys pretty much covered it all. I mean, I'm looking forward to game six. The more the merrier. I know Witt probably don't want one, but I love a game seven, man. I mean,
I'll be very nervous for Tampa if this goes seven, for the simple fact, well, especially if we mentioned if Point's not back, but just, I don't know, man, that mental warfare of like, they're like, oh, we had the 3-1 lead. Are we going to blow it?
No.
I don't know. You think that they're battle tested and they're ready to go? John Cooper said that, you know, we've dealt with adversity in this playoff before, which I don't know, I don't think to this extent and going against an Islanders team, but we'll see.
Actually, I did have a question. This is from ignorance, not picking on anybody. That play, the goal that Eberle scored, should Sergachev have stayed with him, or did he do the right thing by going to
so
the
play? He was kind of like caught flat-footed, so it wasn't like he was playing a usual two-on-one. He's kind of like skating the same direction they are. He was like forward skating, and like he ends up going over to Lee. He certainly could have tried to kind of give the goalie the shooter. That's what you always want to do playing a normal two-on-one. Give the goalie the shooter and just guarantee that the pass won't get through you for a tap-in. It was so fast and happened so quick that when Shattenkirk whiffs, Sergachev's in the middle of the blue line, Lee's off, and he's just standing there. So he's kind of chasing that play.
It's amazing how instinctive it is in some cases where, like, a lot of guys in that case, well, they'll fake to go to him and then go to the other guy because most of the time they say give the shooter to the goalie.
Right,
but if you feel you've caught him in the midst of a stick handle where you're able to take a stab at that thing and, like, not fully commit, you try to do it, and it was just a great pass.
Yeah, no, definitely not taking credit away from
that. And it was right off Eberle's stick. So, interested. There was fucking one other thing that I wanted to talk about in that game. Just Hedman. Jesus Christ. Eighth goal of the playoffs.
Frankie. Because this fucking guy's nonstop.
He's nonstop.
He really is. And he's just picking corners, too. It's a pleasure to watch this guy play.
You know what that was? That was at the All-Star game when the defenseman gets to skate into one. Like Shea Weber.
Yeah, but it was kind of rolling, too.
Yeah, well, okay. So, add another cap in the feather, then.
Good luck putting that cap in the feather.
Or they say the feather and the cap.
I think you said cap and the feather, which would be near impossible.
No, that's good. Well, it's the biz way of putting it. Game six, Thursday night, 8 o'clock tonight, if you listen to the show the day it dropped. Out west, the Stars wrapped up the Campbell Conference in five games after Denis Gurianov's ninth of the playoffs, 3:36 in the OT, gave Dallas a 3-2 victory. Very tough loss for Vegas. They had a 2-0 lead early in the third. They blew it. Goals by Jamie Benn and Joel Kiviranta. Jamie Benn.
Oh, okay.
And
the guy that's just hosing
Joel Kiviranta erased
it. But cocky at this point.
You got to feel terrible for Zach Whitecloud. I mean, he's not really. It wasn't your typical puck over glass.
Oh, I know.
It's a desperation play. He's just trying to bat it away, and such bad luck. I felt awful for the kid, man.
I don't know. I mean, you're going to get 50-50 on this rule. I think it sucks that somebody's season ended because, like, there was no intent there to, for it to go over like that. But I also get the other standpoint of, you know, they're trying to create more offense with if you can't make plays, you're going to get penalized for it. So you see Revo consoling him after and just with the expectations of that team. And you saw that quote right after the game. Riley Smith said, this is far and above the most high-skilled team I've ever been on. Anything less than a Stanley Cup is a major disappointment. And, I mean, you saw it in periods and in some games. Like, I mean, I think one game they outshot them by 13, and one game I think it was 17. And, you know, they controlled a lot of the play. They were seemed to be getting a little bit more of the power plays, at least early on. But this Dallas team, man, they're just – especially to close it out in five too was just even more odd, but they just they're so galvanized right now and they're playing for each other and in a situation where they're in the bubble and I know it's hell for these guys. This is like they're going on 2.5 months here and they're losing their minds, but that like team camaraderie is just kind of taking it to a new level and the fact that they're just able to keep pulling these games off. Like when do you see Vegas blow a 2-goal lead in the third? And the minute they fucking smell blood, they pounce. And I keep getting bent over on the Jamie Benn thing. It's like he's a playoff performer, man. He's one of the only guys out there with no visor on. He's standing up to everyone. Him and Stone barking at each other. He's just not backing down, and it's like it's cool to see. I thought when these guys were coming into playoffs, they were going to be like they started the regular season with. They were 1-7 to start their regular season. They were struggling. And right out of the gate, even in the round robin, And early in that series against fucking Calgary, like people forget they were 12 seconds from going down 3-1. No, they find a way. Radulov, boom, gets the tire. They win that game. Then all of a sudden, you know, with Tkachuk being out, it's a testament to that group. These older guys, I think, realize this is probably their last kick at the can. It's hard to get to even this point.
And they've been dealing with and like being in this bubble. Losing the cup finals, I know from experience, is so heartbreaking. To lose this year is fucking 100 times worse.
They should give them a consolation ring. Like, that's the only time I'm down with it.
These guys are so – imagine being away from your kids this long. This is a fucking grind, and I'll tell you, they are last year's Blues. I think I said this at some point on this show. They are similar to last year's Blues, and you remember that they got robbed in not beating the Blues when Jamie Benn – had the Binnington made that amazing save on the wraparound.
Yeah.
So you've seen what they and listen, I think through four games against Colorado, they'd given up 15 goals. They gave up six goals in the first four games to Vegas? Like it's just I'm so impressed by what they're able to do. And like you realize that when you have three defensemen who can log 25 minutes, Heskinen being the best overall. Klingberg, I can't pump this guy's tires enough. He has the best, most perfect shot for tips and rebounds from the point. And then when he wants to shoot to score, he has a cannon. But he just flicks these wristers, and he had two assists in the clincher. And then Esa Lindell is fucking legit. That guy plays like a lot of hard minutes. He PKs. He's a nice player. Cool. He's so solid, and nobody really knows much about him. Kind of similar to like Ekholm in Nashville, right? Like they're like really good but quiet. And I just think that when Dallas has guys going, and you mentioned the veterans, like when they score the goal, there's a video. I wish I remember because I couldn't even find it to show you. I wish I remembered the Twitter feed, so I'm doing no one any good. I'll try to describe the video. It's a camera that's looking down Dallas's bench. So you can't see the ice. It's solely looking down their bench. And they're all standing up because, you know, that play, there was a lot of pressure on the power play goal. Gurionov scored. And they score, and the bench goes so nuts, exactly like you think they would. And they all hop on the bench, and one guy stays. It's Cogliano, who's been in the league a long time. We've talked about him a bunch. Good friend of mine, played in Edmonton. And he's standing there, and it's just like he's standing there, sheer joy. You can tell he's screaming. He's so fired up. Him and one of the coaches, you know, pound it out, and then he jumps over the boards. It's like the passion this team has. And now, granted, who wouldn't have that passion after going to the Cup Final? But they've been in this for the long haul. Jamie Benn has the little video where you see when he's checking in at the beginning of the bubble, the beginning of the playoffs. He had so many bags, something like that. And he's like, we plan on being here a while, right? It's like a cheesy line, but I think they did.
Yep.
I think these guys are like exactly what you said. They got Corey Perry. Pavelski, who DeBoer coached in San Jose and ironically mentioned when they're talking about this series, he said like, we're playing good. This was leading up to the game five. He said, we're playing good. We're getting so many chances. And he mentioned their best player, Joe Pavelski, is just kind of like, I guess his old coach just talking about how much he respects his game, shoots a backhander that hits the shaft of a stick and goes like a pitching wedge over into the net, and we lose game four. I mean, it was such a game of inches. Like, I wonder if Vegas looks back. Like, do you think they played poorly? I don't know, because they dominated at times. They couldn't score, and they ran into a goalie who's just been on this amazing hot streak. That's the other similarity between St. Louis and Dallas. Yeah, I mean, Binnington's a rookie and kind of comes out of nowhere, but Hudobin was a backup. No one ever would have. If Dallas was in the Cup final at the beginning of this year, everyone's probably telling you, yeah, Ben Bishop's up for the Vezina, correct, and he's like stonewalling everyone. It's a team that I have a crazy feeling about. I'm still on Tampa when they do beat the scumbag Islanders and move on, but Dallas, what a run it's been. And Radulov, can't say enough.
I just, yeah.
Biz.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a couple other things that we had to discuss here.
We talked about something.
Oh, this is what I wanted to address. I personally believe, and the guys in the locker room might say something different. I feel like the goaltending situation, especially with the fact that the contract talks coming out, it just like got to a level where it was so weird, where like something as little as that and that it just can create like a little bit of tension in the locker room. Like there's no reason that team should have. I don't think they should have lost to Dallas. I definitely don't think they should have lost to them in five games. And for them to kind of go out like that and lie flat on the offense, I don't know. It was a drastic halt to what their trajectory was going into that series.
Man, Smith, Pacioretty, and Marchessault didn't score.
Yeah,
I mean, three of your top players right there. So I think that they played well and they dominated stretches, but. Yeah, it's certainly disappointing. Did you have Dallas?
No, I'm pretty sure I had Vegas for the pissing off Dallas fans. But, dude, I mean, full marks to Dobby, man. They got Dobby.
Yeah.
I mean, Hudobin's been absolutely incredible. And like I said, we had him in Boston. We loved him here. He got a nice contract with Carolina. That didn't pan out as he hoped. He kind of bounced around a little. But I love what he's doing, man. I love a great goalie story, particularly a guy like that.
Yeah.
He's been putting a hell of a battle on. Also, an interesting stat is the Stars are the first team to enter the Stanley Cup final with a negative goal differential in the postseason since the 68 Blues. And the 68 Blues, by the way, were in the Cup final because they put all the expansion teams in one division, ensuring that an expansion team would be in the Cup final. So basically, it's been fucking that long with 52 years. And Sagan said it says that analytics are overrated. And needless to say, the analytics community got a pretty good chuckle out of Sagan's quote.
Oh, man. If you say anything negative, you're just like, you're getting...
The analytics mafia comes at you.
The army's coming. Hee-ho.
Must be a scary
hee-ho.
Bunch.
Hee-ho. Wait, that's not nice.
What?
You said you must be a scary bunch.
Yeah, that's not mean.
No, I was being sarcastic. Oh. But going back to that one series against Colorado, though, and I know I've been getting to it with fucking Stars fan. I've jumped on your little rivalry bandwagon, RA. I mean, in that series, I just thought that they'd gained, they'd gotten a little luck given with all the injuries.
Yeah, I mean, if you look back, it was seven regulars out. So I'm happy for Dallas. First trip to the finals since 2000.
Yep,
I think the fifth trip Dallas's fifth trip to the finals, I believe.
It's the third in Dallas, and then
they had two in Mini.
Yeah, they lost to Pittsburgh that year, and then I believe they lost to the Islanders one year too.
The Rick Bonus story
Minnesota wasn't in the league when the Islanders were.
Sure, they were.
Won
Minnesota
won the
North Stars. Sure, they were in the
Islanders
league.
Beat them in one.
No,
of them?
I'm guessing on that in the fifth one. I can look it up right now, but no, the Islanders and North Stars were definitely.
No, I'm sorry, I was thinking of the Wild. I apologize.
That's okay. I appreciate it.
Nothing goes over my head though.
Rick Bonus. Everybody's sending out messages on social media about how happy they are for this guy. He's been around forever.
I want to talk to him. I want to have him on here.
He's
coached for about 400 years.
Yeah.
We're going to get him on, I think.
And, yeah, he might have a Stanley Cup when we end up interviewing him. I reached out to his kid, Ryan. I actually scrapped him in junior when he played for the Brampton Battalion. So he's going to broker the deal on getting him on. But just such a likable guy and getting a lot of love on social media, thinking people think he deserves this for what he's put into the hockey world.
Absolutely. Been doing it for quite a long time. Also, Corey Perry got a little richer. He got a $100,000 bonus for reaching the final. Dallas cap overage is now over $3 million. I'm sure they'll worry about that when they need to. And if he wins the cup, he'll get another $150K. So congrats to Corey Perry on, I saw that tweet payment.
And
that's a drop in the bucket.
I saw that tweet and I had to retake it. I'm like, 100K? He doesn't even fucking know. He's made like 90 million, hasn't he? Like 100K. I'm like, are they even writing about 100K for this guy? He's probably flicking it to a guy who valets his car.
Oh my God.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
All right, a couple of quick notes before we send it over to Todd Fedoruk. Minnesota signed Jonas Brodin to a 7-year, $42 million contract extension. The defenseman had one more year left at a previous 6-year, $25 million deal, so nice little bump in pay. Elliot Friedman is, quote, hearing Bill Armstrong confirmed as Arizona GM at press time that nothing had been confirmed officially yet, but I'm sure if Elliot says it, it's going to be true. Biz, I know you. I'm not looking for confirmation, but I didn't know if you had any input there.
No, I read that on Twitter today, and I don't know anything about him. I don't really cover that side of the world. I just give my shitty hot takes and pick my boogers and eat them. So I wish him the best of luck. I hope he's able to turn this franchise around. I think it's a 5-year deal. You know, there were some other good guys up for the job as well. It's, you know, Sean Burke was a guy that I was personally pulling for just because I knew he was, you know, he's been around and he's seen that. But wish this guy all the best and looking forward to meeting him. If I'm still on payroll by the time I get back.
And we did give a quick check. Yeah, it was 5 total cup appearances for the Minnesota / Dallas franchise. Lost in 91 to Pittsburgh, and it was 81 they lost to the Islanders.
Great call. Actually,
going back to the Coyotes talk, I heard that Calgary's interested in Darcy Kemper, and there's been chitter-chatter. You stay away from my
good,
fucking...
Good, get him out of that...
Shut up.
That... Good for nothing team.
Tree living. If
that
you take
organization
over,
that can't do anything right. Get Shane Doan back in the mix, and I never say a bad word about him again. Deal?
Deal.
That's the cheers.
Deal. But Tree, you stay away from Darcy, buddy.
Hey guys, it's Big Cat, and Fight Week is here. Rough and Rowdy 24 invades Clarksburg, West Virginia this Friday night, April 19th at 8 p.m. Eastern for the first time since Rough and Rowdy 1. Every single fight will be a brand new brawler. And we found the wildest hillbillies the Holler has to offer. Order now to enjoy 20 amateur matchups with no headgear, plus our live ring girl contest after the final bell. These country roads are being paved with blood and grit and balls. Join me and Dave on the call for Rough and Rowdy 24 this Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern. Witness all the chaos with pay-per-view replay available all weekend long on buyrnr.com. That's buyrnr.com.
All right, boys, I think we should probably send it over to Todd Fedoruk right about now.
Fridge, let's go, baby.
Let's go. Without further ado, pal Fridge. Well, it's a pleasure to welcome our next guest to Spit and Chicklets. He piled up over 1,000 penalty minutes in 545 NHL games for 6 different squads, most famously for the Philadelphia Flyers. He's been known to have a scrap or two back in the day. He's also a nice Edmonton boy and a very unselfish fisherman, as we found out on Boston Harbor Saturday. Thanks for joining us, Todd Fedoruk. How's things, Fridge?
Well, things are good, man. It's great to be here, guys. I like this show. I've been listening for a while, man. You guys do it right, so I appreciate you having me on.
A lot of your Alberta boys talk about it.
Oh, they got it. They ask me every week, when am I getting on Spit and Chicklets? You guys have a huge following out there.
Big fall.
I don't know
Alberta.
If you saw my career as an Oiler. they haven't forgot. They continue to watch me.
They flocked and followed, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You're from Redwater, Alberta.
That's it.
So just outside of Edmonton, growing up, minor hockey, playing there.
Yeah, Redwater Renegades, Redwater Truckers. Those were the minor league.
Any other NHLers from your hometown?
Well, there was one. Kent Manderville came through. Wasn't born in there. In Redwater, but lived there for a bit. We actually played in the Flyers together, but no, I'm the only one born and raised at a
Redwater. What are you born in, 79?
79.
79, so you're I'm thinking 7, 8 years old when the Oilers. I mean, I guess Gretzky might be gone by then. But I mean, that was your team, or Calgary was
right there. I remember the '87 Flyers, and I was lucky to grow up in Edmonton in those days. It was Messier, Tikkanen, Gretzky, Fuhrer, Andy Moog.
And then they won when Gretzky left, too. And you were even a little bit older then, which is probably crazy.
Yeah, I remember that time when Gretzky got traded, man. It was just national news every day. Like, the world is ending. We're losing our savior. And the world was over for like a year. And when they won again, that kind of really made it feel good for Edmonton. But, I mean, Gretzky is Gretzky. You know, he was the guy there. So, big trade, man.
You think?
Just a bit. Hey, first off, thanks for coming up, too. We should mention he trekked all the way up from New Jersey, right, to do this interview, so we appreciate that.
He spent
immensely.
The whole weekend with us.
Yeah, well, I mean, we hung out, like I said, we went fishing all day in the Boston Harbor, your first time out on the harbor, right?
Yeah, it was. Hey, you know what? I've been through Boston playing and stuff. We had a couple snow ins. This is a beautiful city. I got to hand it to you, man. I didn't get a chance to walk around when you're playing and stuff.
Yeah.
But it's nice now, and it's a nice city.
It's funny how people, because you've traveled and played in all these cities, not just you, everyone who's played in the NHL, but rarely do you get out and about and see things. Maybe you'll see a restaurant and a bar, but you're not going to be like dealing with what makes cities so special. So it's cool you got to finally spend some time here. We appreciate you coming.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man.
Going back to your minor hockey days, I mean, given the NHL career you had and like how physical and how fucking crazy you were, did all that start playing minor hockey? I mean, were you chucking them like that back then, or were more of a scorer then?
No, I was never minor hockey. It was just I liked hitting, like I liked the physical aspect of the game, and I wasn't a guy that stood out. Wasn't a guy that got a lot of points. I was a big kid early on, and I liked playing physical. I played hockey because I liked hitting. That's why I played. Like I remember the small rinks in Redwater. Like my buddies would come that weren't playing. They'd come to watch the hits.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's what it was like
it
in
was
the farming
about the physicality.
Community. Yeah, Western Canada, that's the way, you know, you play the towns that are surrounded by you, and your team is made up of the 13 kids in town. So if you don't have enough kids, you don't play, or you combine with another town. As we got older, we actually combined with another town, Thorhild, to actually make a team. So there's kids from that town and ours.
So coming up to like the WHL draft and everything, are you just like on the radar as a really good prospect? Are you kind of coming out of nowhere? What's your whole, when you turn 14, 15, 16 road?
Well, here's what's funny is like, I was so out of the loop with the hockey. I don't know if it's culture back then, but we didn't know I got drafted in the CHL, WHL until a year after it happened. So it was like, not a year, but it was later on. I don't know if my dad got a call or something, but it was one of the scouts that actually told us at an all-star tryout that your rights are with the Tacoma Rockets at the time, which had moved to Kelowna that year. So
it was like a pigeon carrier. They sent a pigeon to tell you, but it got shot down
by a
farmer.
I still think it exists in the WHL. It may not anymore, but you were always drafted as a 15-year-old, and basically 2 years before you could play, technically.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure there was an exemption in certain cases, but you're also living in an era where, like, I know when I was drafted, and that was years later, with internet. There was no internet, right? So you just eventually found out you were drafted by this team and they were considering bringing you in for your first year of eligibility?
So the way it happened is the first camp that I got to go to, I didn't get to go to. I had an injury. I cut my tricep in half in the summertime with the uncles on the lake, and I wasn't able to go to camp. And then the next year I went to camp. I don't know if this is a good hockey story, but I didn't want to play. Like I had a really tough year the year before. I got kicked off the AAA team.
And for
it was
what?
The AAA team in Fort Saskatchewan.
Yeah, what did you get the boot for?
Well, apparently I missed the curfew, according to the coach. So
apparently.
I didn't even know what curfew was then.
Show me video. Show me some video to prove it.
Yeah, and then I was just, you know, I would challenge coaches when they would do things and stuff like that, and I just didn't fall in the line. So I was a problem child, but what happened is the coach kept my card, and they need to release your card so you can join another AAA team. They held my card so I couldn't join another AAA team, and I ended up playing B beer league with my uncles. I swear to God, I played beer league with my uncles and a couple buddies that were older than me so I could get rides to the games. But I tell you what, it was probably the best thing for me because I handled the puck more than I had ever handled the puck. These guys were a little slower, so I was wheeling out there.
Well, they were shit-faced.
They were, yeah, absolutely, because I had to bring the beer. So
did that type of off-ice behavior continue when you got to Kelowna, or did that set more of a structure in your life?
Kelowna's a great town.
No, Kelowna's a great town, and it's a party town. You know, and I partied there for sure. You know, and I went away to Kelowna. I was 16, and it's a nice town, and it was cool, man. It was cool to play in the WHL and be young and stuff like that. And early on, I was doing some stuff, extracurricular activities. I probably normal most kids do at 16 years 17. Old, right? I just, you know, took it a little too far, you know.
Was the team any good there? You have some good years when you were there?
Yeah, we had played good. Yeah, we had Kim Dillabaugh. Kim Dillabaugh is the goalie coach for the Flyers now. He was our goaltender, so he was good. We had a tough team, but we were tough as well. Like Dale Purrington was on that team.
Oh,
me and Scotty Parker were rookies together. How about this? So you got Scott Parker, who's 17, right? And I'm 16. It's his first year, my first year. We're rookies. They made us sit together on the bus. I was 210 pounds at the time, probably. Parks is 225. We were close.
We're fighting everyone, we were guys. Close. Like maybe these are the two rookies you can just give their own seats to.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The old sweat box in the back went pretty smooth for us because Parks, he just started elbowing the door and it opened and we just walked out. Nobody said a thing to us. That's
a
beautiful thing.
Different if a rookie's thing. The
tough guy. Yep.
was it odd, like moving away from home at 16, then all of a sudden you're all of a sudden this men's league up until guys like 20 years old and getting into that scrapper role right away?
Yeah, that was like, I shouldn't have done that the first time I did it. Because the first guy I fought in junior, it was the first time I had really fought. And I knew I was going to do it. Me and Parks were going to do it.
Weren't scared at all. More just like...
Well, you were scared, but okay. You were like, I want to see if I can do it. So that kind of, you know, you didn't worry about the fear. And it was a Matt Van Horlick. So he was a Golden Gloves boxer and a veteran tough guy. I think he might have been 20 or 19. And I got into it with him, and he broke my nose and bloodied me up and just speed bagged me. I had no clue what I was doing, and that was my first fight. It was a veteran, good fighter, and I got spanked, you know? And then I just, you know, I wanted to get better after that. And it started from there. And I had a lot of guys to support me, too. Like, Parks, we wanted to be tough, and there was a lot of tough guys in that league at that time. Belak, Rocky Thompson, the list goes on. A lot of guys.
Well, we also had the conversation, I think it was yesterday, and the fact that you didn't necessarily get nervous before fights. It was more of something you just kind of knew you had to do.
Yeah, and when guys talk about that, I mean, you think about the fight, and some guys get anxious and stuff, and I just approached it as that's what I was going to do. So I think it was partly because of the veterans. And this early on, it wasn't really something that bothered me or gave me anxiety, but I had, like, Luke Richardson was a real good older vet that kind of taught me you're a hockey player first, but, you know, if you're going to play this, nobody ever told me to do it. I was fully on board. Like, this is my role. This is my opportunity. I'm going to take it. And I got the shot to do it. But when it had started and I was kind of established as I was going to stay there, these guys kind of, they helped me out. Rick Tockett, Mark Recchi, Eric Desjardins.
Start developing your game.
Work on my game, but know that I needed to fight too to establish myself. That was my role, you know. So I think they'd helped with that and with picking guys to fight because I would just probably make the bad choice and fight the worst guy first. You got to get your feet wet, man. This is still the NHL and... Once you do that, once it's like anything, once you see you can play with them, you're like, I can play in this league. And it's the same thing with fighting. You go toe to toe with a guy that's been there and you hang in there.
Like, okay.
That's what it takes.
Yeah, he's been doing this 10 years. I can do this.
I can do this. Yeah.
And just going off that and fast forwarding a little bit to your NHL career, you said your first ever regular season fight, you could say against who it was, but how it was arranged.
Yeah. So It was Rob Ray. So it was Rob Ray, and it was the trainers that the trainers always set up fights. I don't care what anybody says. This is probably behind the scenes, but the trainers in those days, and they would do it amongst themselves, right? But the trainers are part of the team. They're in the room. So when they get going, it's usually in the morning skate or something like that.
And guys hang with the trainers. They're in the room. Guys, they're just having a coffee. I love being with those guys.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time with those guys. And they were talking amongst, you know, would Razor fight? I'm sure that's how the conversation goes. You know, what do you do, this guy? He's a young kid. He's coming in and
looking for something to prove, Razor.
Looking to prove himself and I remember them saying, yeah, he'll go you, and then talk or not talk. It was Luke Richardson who was actually talking to me. He's like, hey, yeah, Razor, he's a good fighter. He likes to come out of his jersey. Like, gave me all the little tips and stuff, and I was just before the game even started.
He likes to come out of his jersey. That was one of his comments.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, because Razor came out. That was his whole thing. He used to come slip right out and then bare arm you, right? But this was right when the tie downs came in. So that had changed, and it changed. You have to change your style when that happens. But yeah, they told me of things to look out for. But he was a smaller guy, and you know what? He was. It's not that he wasn't tough, man. He's one of the toughest to play this game. Yeah. He was older, and I was younger, and. When you're younger and you're a rookie and you fight a veteran, you get the opportunity to fight a veteran, you win no matter what for showing up.
Yeah.
And I think some of the older guys understand that. Rob Ray was one of those guys. I lined up to him and I said, I still had the number 52 on. So I had a rookie.
Training camp number.
Yep, training camp number. And,
pigeon number.
And yeah, pigeon, total pigeon number. And he looks... we line up right in front of our bench and I'm like, do you want to go? And he's like, who the fuck are you? Oh. Like, just like that, I was like, oh, I'm just a young guy trying to stay here and I need a fight. And he looked back, he's like, 52, eh? Like, this is exactly 52. You sure? And I said, yes, yes. And then we went and it was a good tilt.
Good for him.
I caught him with one and yeah, he didn't have to, but he gave me a shot and I think that's kind of opened the door for me.
Did that positive reinforcement, because I know I felt it too, as soon as I started getting to that role, as soon as you get that feeling in the locker room, like, you know, fucking rights, like you got our back, like you're our guy. It's just like you feel like just as much of a part of a team as like a second liner at that point.
Yeah, you nailed it, man. That's exactly what it is. I felt more of that. I felt closer with that team because you're so young and you're so new to it. The veterans bringing you in and making you feel like you're a big part of it is a lot of that, man. It's a lot. It helps a lot with the development, the stress. But you're 20 years old. You need somebody to look to teach you these things. Like, how do I deal with this? How do I handle this? And when I did good, it was all, you know, they loved it. They rallied around me fighting and being a young guy and doing it the right way. And I loved it, man. That made me feel a part of it.
Your first year in Philly, was that the first year Lindros was gone?
Yeah, yeah. No, he wasn't gone. I think they sat him out all year.
Okay, yep.
And then
in the playoffs, is that when he got hurt?
He got buried. That was 2000 playoffs. He got buried by Stevens.
So, yeah, that was the year before me, I think, when I got there.
I thought you were there that year.
No, I didn't play with him that year. Okay. I didn't play with him. He sat out the year after that year. And Jonesy was actually the guy that got hurt, Keith Jones. He blew out his knee. He blew out his knee. Jonesy's one of the funniest guys you ever play with. And he blew out his knee, and he's like, yep, I'm done, kid. He looks like you're going to get a shot for the rest of the year. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, I ain't coming back. I'm going to retire after this. My knee's blown. And I ended up staying up because Jonesy was out, and the numbers had matched up.
You took that role.
And I took it on. The empty spot was there. I don't think they had a resident, you know, scrapper that was – young and ready to do it.
Which is odd because you feel like that organization, and given what they had in the minors, like always had at least a couple guys cocked and loaded.
Yeah, like those teams in the minors and the Phantoms in the early 2000s were like Garrett Burnett and Frankie Bialowis. Like if you're in the hockey circles, you know who Frankie the Animal Bialowis is. Alligator arms knocking out guys left, right, and center. And he's a tough cookie, man. He's crazy too, but yeah, a beautiful man. Tough teams on those early 2000 minor league squads, but it's funny that none of the Flyers had a tough guy in those early days.
Fritz, some guys' faces light up when they have a fight. I think like Milan Lucic out of today's players, like they get off on it. Did you relish the role when you did it,
No.
Or was it more of like, shit, this is my job?
No, I liked when I won, and I liked when I'd had a good fight. Like, if I was in a good toe-to-toe fight with a guy, I mean, there's a lot to respect in that, and I really liked that part of it. I didn't like the grandstanding and role-playing and all the chirping. I wasn't good at it at all. Like, I tried chirping a guy, and it just never worked out. I wasn't quick-witted. I was too dumb. Too dumb on the ice. Just,
hey, you guys start, were you start, good. Like, you got to know, guys are good. You start reading them off your hand. You're like, fuck, I'm sweating. It's
yeah, exactly. So I would just throw my glove off and punch them, and that would work better. Don't talk.
I would say this. The guys who didn't say a word out there were far more intimidating than the ones who did.
Yeah.
Like Goddard didn't say a word.
Oh.
And they were tough. The quiet ones are tough. They know how tough they are, and they know what they can do to you. So they don't need to talk. They just need to act, and those are the ones you worry about, man. The quiet ones. Dave Brown, Schultze, you know, the old original, man. The quiet guys. Grimson, Semenko. Yeah, those are the tough guys.
You can go back for like days and with names from the 70s and 80s because everybody fought then. Now, you were taking the 7th round, the 97 draft by Philly. What did they tell you? Like, what kind of prospect are you? Or did they even meet with a guy back in those days, like to even like check in
with you? Do you have an agent then?
I had an agent, yeah. I had an agent. I was ranked in the 2nd round in the CHL. I got injured that year, so I dropped a little bit, 5 rounds maybe. And I didn't even know. I don't even think I interviewed with Philly or they seen me. Or it was just maybe a lucky, maybe let's take a look at this kid. But I had no idea it was going to be Philly. I thought it was going to go in the 2nd round. So,
oh, my God.
So yeah, I got the call from the agent because everybody goes to the draft in the first 2 rounds, right? Yeah, maybe, Todd, you should sit this one out. And I was like,
I'm hearing some things, Todd.
A little bit devastated. But, yeah, so I didn't go to the draft. But Donnie Meehan was my agent originally. Yeah, but I gassed him. Probably my second contract actually. Just said I'm not doing anything with you.
Yeah,
and I heard that you hear about this stuff with these fucking agents. I heard that what happened. These guys, so they had 2 players on the team, me and another guy, and they'd leverage my contract to get with the other guy. Said we'll give you this guy for this and this guy for that. So I had some people, you know, close to the team and management and stuff that said, you know, maybe you should consider.
Yeah, you're kind of getting flip-flopped.
Yeah, man. So that was an honest kind of tip in the right direction from somebody that shouldn't have been tipping me in the right direction. So that was kind of my introduction to my second NHL contract, but it worked out. You know, it was based on trust, and I gassed them, man, because I trusted the guys that I was playing with, and I think I got rid of them and hired a Brad Devine. Best agent ever.
And he was your guy for the rest of your career?
He was the guy for the rest of my career. I still talk to him to this day. He's a good man. He's done now, but real good guy from Western Canada.
So when you got to Philly, I mean, you spent 1 year in the minors, coast and AHL, but then you get up and you're playing, and rookie year, like, you became the guy. And you're basically exactly what a Philly fan looks for in a player, especially a Flyers fan. Like, you were running up and down, you're playing that Flyers style. So I'm guessing they must have taken to you right away in terms of, like, when the fans are behind you, it's a different feeling. I wouldn't know, but at least Biz has told me.
Yeah, man, yeah, and I think that's why I make my home in Philly, because even when I got drafted, my dad's like, well, that's the team for you. You know, they play a real tough game. And I was like, right on, Dad. That's right. Let's go to Philly. He's like, where is that? And I'm like, it's way, way far away on the East Coast. And we had to look at a map to find out where it was. But, yeah, I mean, this city and Philadelphia, I felt that they had really embraced that role as fans. Like, and you hear it from behind you. Like, send Fedorik out. Yeah. Two goals down. Or things are a little hairy. Send up Fedorik. You hear them in the back, and they support you. And they, you know.
How many fights were you getting in, like, the first few years in Philly? Like,
I looked to try and get in a fight every game. That was my I was trying to get, well, be prepared to get in a tilt every game. Yeah. So you're ready to go. And, yeah, every game. Yeah, if they had a guy, then the only time you took that night off or that preparation off is when you knew nobody was dressed. So then you could play. You know, you could try and play a little bit.
You try to play at the blue line, and then you get benched. Like, so much for that.
Yeah, you don't get it out. You don't get it out once in the first period or first couple of shifts. You're just going to be grocery sticking. You're going to be sitting and watching and cheerleading. So that's the way it was coming in. You didn't get minutes to get better. You got mistake-free hockey, and if you mess that up or you don't work on it, if you're not ripping rims at the practice next day, if you don't get it on the wall 20-30 extra after, working on the wall work, they're not going to see you and keep you around. If you don't get it out and you get sat, that's just that's the way it was back then. I don't know if it's like that now.
So the lockout year, you end up going back to the minors and playing with like the Carter and the Richards as that that type of movement was coming in. And you did, correct, get the opportunity to win a Calder Cup?
Yeah, we won the Calder Cup the year of the lockout.
Down, second round.
That was I didn't play that game. That the one game we had against you. What was it? You guys had like a
dude. We were
you guys
down,
just shit the bed.
We were down 3-1 in the series, and we had a game in Philly, and we had beaten Bingo in the first round. Bingo crushed every record that year. They had Spezza and Philly was good. They were good all year, and then they had Carter and Richards come, and so we're down 3-1, but we're up 4-0. In the second period of game five. So, you know, force a game six here. We're going home. You never know. Ding, 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 ding. We lost 8-4 or 7-4. It was the biggest shit kicking. And usually when a season ends, you know, at the end of the game, like, however it happens, like, the coaches are like, good season. You know what I mean? Yeah. That was just like, you motherfuckers. It was basically like an end of the season. Like, we had a game the next day. You're just like, okay, see you later. And then the coaches' meetings a few days after that.
Real hate.
That team
was
so good. You guys were so good that, and when those two came, it was like, all right, I don't think anyone's going to be able to stop these guys. My boy Freddie Meyer was on D. They just had, you had so many players.
I mean, Sharpie. It's an NHL all-star roster. With Dennis Seidenberg, Yoni Pekkanen, Antero Nidamaki, he's a starting goalie. Litzy, legend, backup, Neil Little. Patrick Sharp,
John Sim.
John Sim, who's a
John Slaney.
John Slaney, you know my
he was still using wood
they
twig,
say you
wood
never forget the guys
then.
You play with.
He was. He'd have a wood twig, big defenseman, lumbering around. And I think somebody every time like somebody chirped him, he's like, "Guy scored the winning goal in World Juniors. Don't chirp him."
So as big as a bummer as you know the fact that there's a lockout, you're not playing the NHL after just spending you know the better part of 2-3 years there.
Yeah.
Was it like because the team was good, was it bearable, or were you still like, "Oh fuck, this ain't the same"?
No, I was a rookie for the first 5 years of my career, so going down in a lockout was not a surprise. Like literally, I had to do if I didn't show up in rookie camp. In camp, like it was like, well, why aren't you here? Well, I've been in the league for 3 years, guys. What do I? You just had to do that. You had to be the guy there. And I don't know where I was going with this. What was the question you were asking?
Well, just about being back down in the minors.
Oh yeah,
in the
right.
NHL,
so
on the flip side, you have this unreal wagon, and then all of a sudden, I think it was close to playoffs because Junior was over, and then Richards and Carter end up signing, and then you get that injection into the playoff squad. So.
Yeah, that was cool. I've never seen anything like that in hockey where two guys come in. Like, and we were on a run, so nobody was worried about where they were inserted to the lineup, but we weren't expecting to go 1-2 down the middle.
Yeah, people were like, these guys are good, but you know it's still a high-level league. How good are they going to be? It was like, oh, boy.
And they came in. It was Providence, I think, they came in at, and or maybe sooner. I'm not sure when they came in, the memory. And it was Richie. We seen the lineup, and nobody batted an eye. Nobody questioned it. You were just on that
Which
mission.
Was odd for that period of time because, like, usually when guys came up, like, they had to, like, fill in roles and, like, earn that spot. So especially given the fact you'd had a good team already, these guys go first, second line, center, and that's cool that you guys were able to embrace that.
Well, I think it has to go to the first game that they played with us, too. I don't know the stats or anything, but I just know that if they wouldn't have played to a certain level or caliber, then there would have been problems, right? But they came in and they played full stride. They were studs, man. They were studs, and then that's when we really started believing, like we're gonna win this thing, like the whole way.
It's so true because you're
great
thinking,
guys
like, if,
too.
If these first round picks come in and they're thrown in the top two lines, and maybe the guy who was playing first line center is bumped down, he's like, what the fuck can these guys do? All of a sudden, Richards toe drag goal, next shift Carter fucking snipe bar down. You're like, okay, there's nothing you can say.
Yeah,
what are you gonna do?
And Richie's a leader too, man. Like this guy, there's leaders in this game, and I didn't get that much time to play with him, but the time I did get to play with him, I really enjoyed him as a young player, and I liked the way that he carried himself. It was different, but it wasn't bad. He did things his way, and that's what you want leaders to do. You want to follow the guys that kind of. This is the way that we want to do it. And he had the team, you know what I mean, in those later years. And I liked him as a player. I liked him as a player, and I liked him as a teammate. He was a good guy.
Are you surprised that Justin Williams is still playing? I know he was 18.
Mr. Game 7. He was so lippy when I started. He was 19.
Cocky.
And cocky, and rightfully so, but I got in a lot of tilts for that kid early on, so he helped my fighting career. But, right, hey, you got these. That's what it's about. He was a small guy, and he was playing in an era where, like, 250 was... Oh, I was the only one 250, but 220, 230.
That's why they call you the fridge.
That's why they call me the fridge. And Willie came in, and this kid just wins. He's just a winner, man. Like, even pool or ping pong, anything. You got him. You got him on the ropes. You got 8 balls left. Willie, I'm kicking your ass. And then he'd clean the table on you and
then chirp you.
Just win and chirp and woo!
He's like pigeon.
Throw up the thing. He's like, you fucking loser. Just won all the time, things like that. Yeah, he's a special player, too.
You shared the locker room with Mr. Styles himself, Jeremy Roenick, for a couple of years. Did he leave any oxygen for the rest of you or what?
No, but I learned how to have a good time and play this game with Jeremy Roenick. You can have a good time, and you should have a good time, and you should have the boys together without brass around and, you know, at the bar, and you got to do that stuff. And he was good about that because he did it right. You know what I mean? He'd plan it and he'd set it up and he'd make sure that all the guys knew about it and all the guys were there and we were in a setting. And he was really good at stuff like that. And there was older guys too. Like JR had a thing where he'd like to play his own way. And when he came in and Rex and Rico Desjardins, you know, he bought in as well to the system. There's a lot of veterans on that team. And he bought in, and he played some good hockey for us, man. But it was fun, man, with JR.
You played, you know, you're up, and you're having a lot of success doing what you did for the Flyers. And then 2004-05, you spend pretty much the whole year in the AHL. Was that, like, hard for you, or was it – did it not come as a surprise after camp?
I think it was more about, like – I was in the NHL. We were locking out, and I'd become a scab, right? Like, they were like, you were worried about... I didn't care about that. I was young enough. I needed to keep playing, so I didn't care about that. And I wasn't making any money then anyways. I needed to play.
But I'm saying, like, did they even question you going down there because of the time you'd spent before in the NHL? Because most of those guys weren't even allowed to do that, right? How did it come to fruition?
They asked me to play.
Oh,
yeah.
So
they asked me to play, and I said, yeah, I'll sign an AHL contract. I wouldn't mind making some money and playing, because it was my third year, and I couldn't afford a year off. That's the peak years of your development if you're going to, you know, turn into something better. And I went down there, and I started out kind of rough because, you know, they said, you know, you're not down here to fight and all this stuff. And I was like, okay, yeah, I'm going to get to play. And it was good. I got third line minutes, second line minutes. And I played a little bit. But the first game, Zenon Konopka comes and asks me to fight. And I'm like, no. And
then get away from me.
A little later, he's like, come on, man, let's go. And I'm like, no. And then three times. I have a rule of three times. If a guy asked me to fight three times, it was like, that's disrespectful. So I'd have to fight. Because you say no twice, the guys, you know.
The trainer probably told him. You gotta ask him three times.
Trainer set it up.
Three fight rule.
And then we went. It was a good fight, and so that started that. But I was on the bench, and Freddie Meyer was on that team. I was on the bench, and they sent the clapper. We were on the power play. They sent the clapper, ripped it around, and Freddie Meyer. I watched his skate because he went onto the boards, put the foot there, and it just ramped off the toe. And Riley Cote is in front of me, one of the most intense guys you'll ever meet. He's in front of me, and I look past him, around him, and sure enough, bang, right here, and put a hole in my head about the size of a loony. And I first game busted my orbital or my sinus cavity up here, and then Riley's sitting right beside me, and he's like, he's really intense. He's like, dude. Just hit you in the head, man. And I'm like, I'm in pain. It hurt, man. And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, Jimmy. Jimmy's our trainer. Jimmy, Thor just got hit in the fucking head with a puck, man. Right in the fucking head. I'm like, Miles, quiet, man. Like, I fucking
my
hurts
eardrum.
Right now. He's like, is that hit you right in the fucking head square? And I'm like, yeah, man. Like, there's a hole in my head. Stop talking. It hurts. So I go back into the room. I'm getting geared down. And sure enough, I'm lying on the trainer's table and Cote half his gear down. Dude, that hit you right in the head, man.
Get away from me.
He cared. He cared. But yeah, that's how my AHL career
was, like,
started.
He was like the old school baseline test.
Yeah.
Last thing I'm going to ask you about Philly before we move on to Anaheim, which where you played. You guys had a fucking wagon that year.
Yeah.
Ken Hitchcock. We get some funny impersonations of him. I'm sure you saw some funny stuff out of him.
I think that's why I got traded. I think he caught me imitating him a couple times. I had the assistant coach ask me to give him a little imitation. I was weird, man. I didn't have to pay attention to the X's and O's, right? I should have probably, but I didn't. And I paid attention to the mannerisms of my coaches. And Hitch had a few mannerisms that I couldn't stop. He had tiny hands, the smallest hands, and he'd flex his cuffs. Before every meeting, he went through a routine. He'd flex his cuffs and he'd, guys are going to be laughing. He'd flex his cuff, he'd wrap his tie, and he'd hit the cooler.
He had a little thing.
He did it all the time, and he wiggled when he walked. He had a funny walk. And John LeClair and JR are my bookends, and I was in the corner stall. And I used to do this all the time. And these guys, they couldn't keep a straight face anytime Hitch walked around that corner. They'd have to start the meeting with their heads down like this. And I'd be like, Johnny, JR, get your heads up. Coach is in here. They just giggled all the time. It was just funny. And I just, that was kind of the thing that year, is imitate Hitch a lot. But you know what? In his defense, he was a good coach. Like, from an X's and O's guys, you learned more under him. And very, I appreciate it. Yeah, you're very prepared, but at the end of the day, like, you're just a miserable first place team, and that's what it was like. It was, he just wore on you, and he wore his welcome everywhere he went. Like, I'm not taking away from his credibility as a coach. He's a good coach, but maybe not the best guy. You know, maybe not the best with his social skills and stuff like that. And maybe odd. That was part of his tactics. You know, because he pissed guys off.
You're talking about the type of coach you've won 8 in a row, and you think you're going to be going to the rink, and it's, you know, you guys are going to be laughing and snapping the puck around, but no, it's just like it's very tense. And Sutter was the same way in LA, and it eventually, you know, wore on guys. And I feel like Tortorella is an older school guy who was able to adapt, at least a little bit in that sense.
Yeah, I agree. And adapt is the key word, because you're not changing the guys. You adapt with the game. And Torts, I think he's done a tremendous job, because he's one of those guys that was a tough love guy. I never had him as a coach, but I played in Tampa with those guys, and Marty St. Louis and LeCavalier spoke volumes of him. Yeah, he gets in your face, and yeah, it might not be the way, but he's honest, and he's fair with you, I've heard. So you guys didn't mind it when he razzed on you, you know, in those times. Now it's not the same way, and I think he's changed the tune a little bit.
Well, speaking of grumpy coaches, then you had Randy Carlyle in Anaheim for a couple of years. How was your relationship with him?
How'd you hear about the trade there and stuff? How did that all go down to get to Anaheim?
And that was in the summer. Clarkie called me. So what happened with that, I found out later that Hitch wasn't good with younger players, right? And I think Clarkie in the time, it was time for me to try and get some minutes and develop, right? And I don't think they seen eye to eye on that. And Clarkie made the decision to trade me out west to Anaheim. I think Berkey was trying to build a certain style out there and was looking for certain players. I mean, you look at that team, a lot of us were Western players and played with a certain edge and a certain level of grit. And yeah, that's why I think that happened. So I got a shot with Berkey, man. He gave me a good shot. And, you know, right when I got there, he said, look, I want to play like the bullies. This is what he said. He wanted to instill a style of hockey that was rough and rugged and in your face. And he kind of gave me the reins with that. So I took that on full bore. And I think I was ready at that time in my career. So that's how that trade went down.
But you also had Teemu Selänne, man. Was he maybe the most talented teammate you ever had? I know you had quite a few of them.
He's awesome. He's the happiest guy I've ever played with. And he's a happy man and enjoyed the game. That was a great, like, comeback from him, because that lockout year he had to recoup his knee. And like, I think a couple years before, he was under Granato on the fourth line with Peter Orel and going downhill. And that year he recouped and came back and was flying. He had that step where he could get away from guys. And Randy Carlyle and him always had it out, but in a fun way. Randy Carlyle was a good coach. You know, early on, he was a rookie season, and he was feeling us out. He had a lot of good veterans, Todd Marchand, Scotty Niedermeyer, both Niedermeyer brothers. And And then he had some young studs, too.
I find it interesting. So you go from this dynamic of where these two young studs drafted in the first round come up to Philadelphia, and now you're playing with two other guys in a similar situation in Getzlaff and Perry. And yeah. you get to see these guys early on as well. Very similar in just the way they came in. And I mean, there were already guys in Anaheim that had that older presence, like the Scotty Niedermeyers and those guys.
Yeah.
But similar in a transition where you're all of a sudden these young guys are all of a sudden the guys.
Yeah, and it happened quick, too. Like, Getzy and Perry came in, and they were our leading goal scorers, like, right away, right out of the gate, like, first 15 games in. And so they're leading your team. We're on a road trip, and I think they were actually leading our team in points 1 and 2. And Berkey sends them down after they come to rinks with new cars. So Getzy came. Yeah, this is a great story. It's probably something that should happen for every player. Some guys are like, everyone should spend time in the minors. These guys, maybe you can blue light them. They were good, but you know what? Probably turned out pretty good for them because they didn't go down for a little stint. They went down for a good month. They rode the bus. They put in their time, and it was probably the best thing for them. You don't see it like that, but I mean, we were even questioning it too. Like, well, they're leading our team in scoring.
Yeah, we need these guys.
Can you keep them here? And he's like, well, and they need a stint. Everyone needs a stint in the minor, and Berkey's kind of like that. And it worked out good for them, you know. Look at the players they are today. But I got the opportunity to play with them, man. Like, it was good because they were so young, and the lines were kind of set. And I don't know. I don't know if it was that they were tentative, but they were 18-year-old kids. So, you know, the protection factor, I think, helped them play. I just said, you guys can do whatever you want out here. Nobody's going to do anything. Nobody's going to touch
you. As long as you put 15 off my ass and as long as you guys can do whatever the fuck you guys want.
I'm trying to get 10 goals. I got a side bet with Tamo that I'm going to get 10, and he's gonna take me to dinner in a limo with a fucking hat on and everything.
To his own restaurant.
To his own restaurant. That's exactly what the deal was. If I scored 10, and we made this deal, and I had 7 and halfway through the year.
No, you didn't get it.
I didn't get it. No, I ended up with 7.
He was probably fucking. He was probably paying Perry and Getzlaff to stop putting them off your arse. That's
what exactly. Yeah, I had a lot of third assists inside our blue line.
Instead,
yeah.
You had to go caddy for him.
Yeah, exactly. No, those guys were good, man. Yeah, I had a good season with those. And you know what? I learned to play a little bit better because they were just so skilled, man. It was fun to play with those guys.
I think you might be the only Twitter avatar out there that's an x-ray of somebody's skull, which is your own. You got to tell us the story behind that. I mean, you can make out some of the screws in there, too. But
Docked is the story. That was just, that's my hardware, man. I'm proud of that shot. People think I'm crazy for liking that and going through that, and that's bullshit, man. I put it all out there for my teammates and got hurt and tried to get back on the horse and just kept going. That's what we do, and if you're willing to sacrifice, there's a lot of honor in that. And I think my teammates always appreciated that. And even Biz, you know what it's like, man.
What was the final result of that whole injury, if you could describe it, like in doctor's terms?
Oh, so this injury was broken orbital, blown out orbital, broken cheekbone, zygomatic arch, and I think eye socket. So I don't know what the eye
and
socket.
And who threw the punch?
Derek Bougard.
Oh.
6'7", 275 pounds. But he didn't punch from... He had the punch from here, not here. So it was an awkward fighting a guy like that. And I put myself in a bad position. I was wide open. And I tried to come back with a back fist to just... I knew I was vulnerable. And I tried to come at him with a back fist to keep him from throwing. Because just a tap to the face will stop him. But I was coming this way. He was coming this way. And the face broke. So when that happened, I didn't get knocked out, but you instantly know. If you bust your nose, you're like, yeah, okay, something's wrong. I knew something was wrong, and I touched my face. I forget who the line mate was. He was in a lot of my fights, and he loved the way I fought. He's an older guy, and he's like, oh, Friggy.
Mayday? Scampanello?
Yeah.
Oh.
No, it might have been Mayday. Mayday. But he was there. He was there in a lot of them, and he said, ooh, Friggy, you're hurt. And I knew I was hurt that time. And I went by their bench, and Bronco Radivojevic actually played with me in Philly. So we were close, and he was kind of chirping me like, ah, Friggy, you got caught there. And as I went closer to their bench, the smiles of elation from the loss from me their faces kind of dropped because they're like, you could see it was indented. And that's when I knew. I was like, oh, man. You're like, you're going off the ice and people are like, I'm like, what's wrong, guys? And then
looks
the doc.
Great now, though, dude. Hey, whoever did the work, think about it.
Yeah, quick plug. Want to do a free swipe up or
I
something?
I can't remember his name.
Dr. Vinny Boombuds.
I can't remember his name, but he was in Anaheim, that doctor. He passed on now, but yeah, he fixed me up. And
so in the ambulance right to the hospital? Or did they do stuff there? Do you remember kind
of
what happened?
I was in Minnesota. So what happened is I went in the back, their doc came in, and I started blowing my nose, so my sinuses came out of my nose, right? And he's like, don't do that. And I was trying to get the pressure off, and he's just trying to touch it, and he's like, you need to go to the hospital. So we went to the hospital, spent the night in the hospital. They didn't do anything, loaded me up with drugs, and then we had to fly back. Oh. So we flew back to Anaheim for the surgery.
So now more pressure on your fucking
face. Oh, it was a fucking lovely flight with the trainer. Skahan came with me, and he was awesome, man. He was awesome because he was mad at anybody that was getting in our way, slowing us down. He's like, get out of the way. We got to get this guy on the plane. He did all that. And I remember that. I remember because I was in a lot of pain, man. And I had to take that flight and get back to Anaheim.
Was that the first and only time you ever fought Bogart?
No, I fought him before. And I thought he did pretty good against him. I thought I won that one. He came out of his jersey and stuff. But I'd fought him before that earlier.
Was that your toughest injury as a pro or as in
yeah, that was the worst one. I was never the same after that one. I had broken this side against Cairns earlier in my career in Philly. He broke this side with the left. Cairns is a big puncher,
there,
man. Yeah.
Pittsburgh.
Yeah, and I put him down. Yeah, good man too.
Oh,
real
great
good man.
Guy.
When you
great
say you
guy.
Weren't the same, like, and we talked about this over this weekend is.
Yeah.
When you come as this new fighter, you have this spunk about you and you're like raring to go. Did after that surgery and everything that you've gone through, did you kind of question whether you wanted to even keep doing it anymore or you just knew you had to, but the passion wasn't there?
No, the passion was there. When it was about earning a living. Like I had to prove that this injury wasn't going to stop me. I was only 26, so I was young and I had a lot of years left and my body was healthy. It was just my face. So it wasn't that I didn't want to do it. I knew I had to do it to earn a living and keep earning money. You know, I had more years left, but I knew that at any, like I taken another shot there, I could lose my eye and, you know, so that goes through your head. You know, you don't want to lose your eye and you don't want, at some point you got to draw the line. Right. And I just didn't, I had too much years left. I didn't have like, money in the bank, and those come into play, you know. And I tried to get back on the horse, you know. I just said, you know what, the only way to, if you fall off a horse, get back on it. And I was never the same. I was always protective of that the injury, and I talked with a couple doctors like, well, what could happen? And you gotta tip your hat to the docs. They're never gonna tell you you're never gonna be able to do it, you know. It's if it's gonna break, I mean, you're fighting. If it's gonna break, it's gonna break again. But you got to start thinking about those things. And I was always on defense after that. So I never had the cowboy. Like, I like to fight like a cowboy, get in a fight, take hits, give hits. Somebody goes down, that's who wins. But you get broken face, you can't take those hits anymore. Yeah. And you got to worry about it. I had kids at this time. So there's a whole other ball game now coming into play. So I was never the same fighter after that. And it was a lot harder to get in fights too, because guys would ask me when I'd ask them, are you sure? What about your face?
Oh, no, yeah.
Yeah, and they didn't want to do it themselves. And I would be like, I have to fight him. This is my job, man. I have to show up. If
those
I don't do this.
Those are the tough years.
Those were the toughest years for me. I went back from Anaheim when a first-place team where we knew we were going to win the cup that year in October, man. We knew and we believed that. And I got injured and ended up getting traded back to Philadelphia to, like, it was the worst year in Philadelphia's history that year. So first to worst is, like, that's kind of the worst thing you can do.
Yeah. And the year before that, of course, Anaheim made a bit of a run. I know you played in 12 playoff games yourself. And when we were talking this week, you said Anita Meyer said something interesting in the locker room before the year they ended up winning it. Right?
Yeah.
When you guys got beat out.
Yeah, and it was a great statement because it sent us into the summer hungry. Like, we knew something was going on this summer and we were all charged. And he didn't say a lot. And you often hear about the guys that don't say much. And when they do say something, you perk up. And Scotty was one of those guys. And he just said, like, we were a really young team. The owners were new. Coaches were, and when I say new, it's the first time these owners, the Samuelis, had owned a team, right? Berkey was his first time in Anaheim as a GM. Coaching, first times, and when a young team. So he's just like, and we thought we should have beat Edmonton that year. You know, we figured we should have beat them, and we thought
they
we
had
a better
Pronger,
team.
Correct?
They had Pronger. They had gotten a couple key wins at the right time, and we still felt we could beat them, like we were the better team. And he just said it. I don't remember word for word, but it was somewhere along the lines like, you know, it's, you don't choose to win the cup chooses you. And you have to sometimes be patient and wait for that time, but you can't falter and you can't shake. I believe, like a lot of you, that this year should have been our year, but that's just the way this goes. And we can't change that going into next year. And
on
that's all he said.
On to the summer.
So
boys.
All we were doing was like, it wasn't our time, but we're not done.
Yeah.
So that's what we went into the summer with. We came back, and come October, then things started happening in the summer. I mean, we got Pronger. You know, and then when you get, you're on a team, and you have all those parts, and then you get bing.
The final
bing,
part.
Bing, you know? Yeah, and that was Pronger. We had Pronger and Niedermeyer as our 1-2. Come on, like those guys are studs. They're legends.
How crushed were you when you got traded after you got hurt?
Oh,
you got to think like you finally, you know, you feel like you're part of this team, and you know you've experienced winning a Calder Cup, and now you're this close to a Stanley Cup. And did you feel let down when they let you go? Given the fact that it was after you got injured, fighting for that team and defending those guys.
I did, but I think that the way that it went, I did. I was upset, yeah. I especially when they won. Like, I watched every game. I tortured myself. I watched every game. And...
yeah, we get that in common.
You're right. It's the worst, especially when you're close with those teammates, man. And I was close with those guys, a lot of them. It sucked, man. It sucked.
Who'd you get traded for again? Wasn't it Peros?
Well, I know. I think I got traded for a pick or something like that because it was Peros, and Thornton was down in the minors with the team.
Okay.
And Berkey needed to play a certain way, so... I could understand the trade. I don't understand why it happened as soon as it did. Like, I was still in the hospital when I got traded.
Really?
I just got out that day, actually.
Yeah.
So they were able to... So they knew the injury and everything. Yeah, that's odd. Do you think maybe get another shot before he sends you back in?
Well, maybe some things were said between the doctor and somebody. Who knows? Because he told my wife that I'd never play again and, you know... I mean, the injury was bad. He said he's had car accidents worse than this. So it was, he was probably looking out for my, whatever, it doesn't matter. But I got fucking traded and I didn't like it at all. But you know what, when I understood after the fact, because the team played a certain way and they needed to continue to play that way because it gave them success. So, you know, Peros came in and I remember shaking his hand when I seen him in there. I said, take care of my boys, man. And that was kind of how I left it. And he's like, I'm happy to be playing here. Because I think he got sent down or something. Or he was going up and down between Colorado and whatnot. So that's kind of how that went. It was awkward, man. Because he was in the dressing room when I went in the dressing room. And
To get your shit?
To get my shit.
You just
I was still injured and
you.
Stuff. And yeah, and that's fine.
Game.
You got to play this way and go get it, boys. I'll watch.
Yeah, you actually went from Philly to Philly from Mannheim for a fourth rounder.
Yeah.
That's what it was.
Were you at least happy to be, sorry to interrupt, Jerry, at least happy to be going somewhere that you were at least familiar with, given that you'd just experienced this awful injury, which, you know, you don't know what the ending result's going to be. You get traded away from all your buddies who you think you got a chance to win the cup.
Yeah.
But at least I'm going home where they love me and the fan base enjoys me. And
yeah, and I think that's probably what the case was. Like, I mean, you got to think that these guys that are in control of our lives, they have a little place in their hearts for us. And I think with my relationship with the Flyers, I mean, these guys were very good to me. They gave me a shot in more ways, you know.
Yeah.
So it was probably – and my wife was from the area. So it was good that we came back to this. If we were going to go anywhere, why not go where you're kind of familiar? That's, I guess, a positive out of it.
Yeah.
You ended up playing in Minnesota for a little bit as well. I want to ask about Jacques Lemaire, Hall of Fame player, coached over 1,200 games. I think he's one of the most underrated coaches in the last 30 years. What was your experience like with him?
Well, if you can't listen to a guy that has a cup on every finger on the ring, you're not a fucking hockey player. So, and Lemaire got the good guys to play like grinders, and he got the grinders to play like skilled guys. And I think he got the most out of his players, and I really enjoyed my time with Jacques Lemaire. I thought he was the best coach I'd ever played under. And
no shit, huh?
By far, I thought he was the best coach I'd played under. And I think it was the way that he motivated guys. And he said it one time, it ultimately comes down to love. So he said, you really have to be a good coach, you have to love your players like they're your own. And to get the most out of them, you got to know them like that. And that was something that I wasn't used to hearing in the tough old world of hockey. But
yeah,
I respected it, man, because he was had us prepared in the way he approached the game. He was a mad scientist. You know, he had different ways of doing things. He was a good coach.
What was the longest term deal you signed in as a pro?
3 years.
3 year deal? Was that 3 year deal? Phoenix,
yeah. Don Maloney gave me a shot there. $3 million over 3 years. The big deal for a tough guy. You make the $1 million mark.
Million a year.
There was only two guys that did it before me, and it was Donald Brashear and Ty Domi. Ty Domi set the stage for us. But he put up 20 goals and stuff. But
yeah, he said Pat Burns was a big reason for that and allowed him to play and really – you know, embrace not only the fighting aspect, but the fact that he was going to be playing with some decent players. And like you said, the 1 year he backed it up offensively.
Yeah, he did. He did. So guys, you know, I put in enough time, but I was still injured. So I look back at it now, and I got to think that that's kind of the way hockey takes care of the game, of the players. Sometimes, like I probably, if you look at that from an investment point, I was damaged goods, then I still got that deal. So
that's what I was going to say, is you actually had a good year in mini, though, to get that deal after all the injury that happened. Which
all
is
the
nice.
Injuries, and I think that's Lemaire. Like, I got some the karma. Chance to play, and I probably some good karma coming my way, but it worked out. I got the call from Gretzky. I was on, how about this? Like, I'm from Edmonton, right? You got to understand this. Wayne Gretzky calling anybody is cool, but Wayne Gretzky calling me, being from Edmonton, being from Redwater, I was smitten. We were on the beach in Avalon. I was with my family, and I know it was free agency, so it was like a couple days after free agency as they trickled down to me, right? I wasn't being the guy signing the first day in free agency. Leftovers, and then he's like, yeah, hello, this is Wayne Gretzky, and I went like this. I stood up to my family. I was like, shut the fuck up, everyone! Shut the fuck up. It's Wayne fucking Gretzky. Hey, how are you doing, Mr.
Your dad's
Gretzky?
Like, fuck off.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And he's like, "Well, it looks like we just signed you, and welcome to the team. And you know, we're looking forward to having you out in Phoenix. Where are you?" And I was like, "Yes." He goes, "Yeah, you're from Edmonton." So he touched on Edmonton a little bit, and it's funny because Timmy Kerr actually owns a real estate company down there. So I signed my first like $1 million, my ticket. That's my ticket. $3 million, 3 years over $3 million. That was my ticket. And I signed it in his office, and it was pretty cool. You know, I got to go to Phoenix, and it's a beautiful city, man.
Good for you.
The last professional season, it was probably, I don't know if it was unusual for you, but you played for a former teammate in Rick Tocchet.
Yeah.
What was that relationship like? Did it change at all? Did he respect your
game?
He
sat me for fucking 10 straight games. No, it was good. Tockett's another one of those guys. Like, you know, it was his first year as the head coach. So I don't know what happened the year before and whatnot, but I enjoyed playing. Tock was a guy that I looked up to as a player. I got to play with him as well and played under him in Tampa. But by that time, it was, you know, it was nearing the end of my career. Adam Oates was there, and I did a lot of work with him off ice and stuff like that. But he couldn't save this guy. Get me another career, man. I was too far gone.
Oh, so you've debunked Adam Oates and what he could do with players.
Yeah.
So, okay, congratulations.
Yeah.
Vince Oates is like, I can work with anything. But then I saw that. It's fucking, I'm not a miracle worker here.
He was just like, maybe it's time you're done. Like, maybe it's time to think about doing other things.
So you actually, I was gonna ask, though, you kind of knew that was it. I mean, you've been through so much.
Well, yeah, 10 games in a row, damaged goods. I was 29 years old, you know.
It's tough,
30
though, man. It's so young, you know, and all of a sudden it's over.
Well, yeah, I'd done some shit to deserve that, but, you know, made some bad choices and shit, and they bought me out. They bought out my contract, so that's how that ended.
So you didn't even get the whole $3 million.
I didn't get the whole $3 million, but you know what? I wasn't a responsible player. I was fucking around off the ice and.
Well, like, we didn't really touch on that much, and, like, you know, we have a decent sized platform here, and we think it's an important message. You've been 10 years sober now.
Yeah,
Congratulations. That's like, that's incredible. And of course, we've mentioned on the podcast before, that's like an everyday battle. But, you know, what was it like trying to balance this, like this career while going through these wild ups and downs and, you know, where it brought you?
Yeah. Well, early on, there's a whole story to this, but early on, it was the teammates that embraced, you know, me being sober in Philadelphia. And like, I was 20 years old. So you're supposed to start drinking when you're 21 in the States. And I was done. I was fully done by 20. So I kind of approached the team and put it all out there, and they were more supportive than I'd ever imagined. So like, if there's times and you need to get away, not ever a problem. Like, I was the Ninja Dust King. So
yeah,
and they let me just get away. So, but in Tampa, it progressed. You know, I relapsed over a couple of years before that, and it got to the point in Tampa where, you know, it was bad, and I had to walk away from the game. So yeah, I didn't have to walk away from the game. My contract was bought out, but I didn't seek to find another contract at all. I had to work on some things, and I had to take a year to really try and get my shit back together, man. There's a lot more to lose when you've got kids and a wife and a life that you built up and a reputation that, in all honesty, I made the choice to pick that shit up and get back in that, and it fucking takes things from you, you know, slowly. So it took my career from me, and you know what? I made it right and got the help that I needed to get. And
good for you, man.
Hey, that's the part of it that you gotta get to a place where you can reach out for help, man. If it gets dark and deep for guys, you always have somebody that's around you. You got your teammates or whoever it is, man. You got to talk. Well, you got to reach out for help. It's not a weakness at all. It's strength. When you're down there and you need to fucking ask for help, it takes a lot of strength and courage to fucking build up that little bit of juice you need to say, I got a fucking problem and I need some help. So
I think this would be a good time to mention your wife, who we talked about. She stuck by you during these difficult times. You have three beautiful kids out of it.
Yeah. You're going to fucking get me crying, Biz.
Buddy, this is what this podcast is about, right? It is a brotherhood, and it is emotional. And I think that a lot of guys have been through these ups and downs, and some of them are still on the downs. And I think the conversation is important, because like, there's a lot of people out there who looked at you like you were this, bigger than world thing. And knowing that you also went through those types of things helps them to normalize it and get the help they need.
Yeah. We have a fucking high octane lifestyle. We've got to go, we've got to release, we've got to relieve ourselves. And that's part of the nature of the things that we do. We operate where very few people can operate, and things get fucking hairy, and things can get broken, and things can go sideways. It's the nature of the business that we play. And some guys turn to things that they're not supposed to turn to. And I was one of those guys. And that's very prevalent in our game. It's very prevalent to society now. And it's worse than the pandemic that we're in, I think. I think this is something we've got to deal with at a societal level. But you talk about my wife and my family, and having somebody that's there for you, you know.
That just means the world.
Yeah.
It just makes it.
Sometimes in life, you just get that. You get a little gift from the big man upstairs, and she was one of those people for me. So she's somebody that makes me better, you know, on a daily basis. And sticking by somebody that's going through shit like that, just wanting to be better is all she wanted, so. You know, I tried. 10 years is a nice little chip on the shoulder to say, you know, I put that bottle down. But on a daily basis, I don't regret for one second, or you know, I don't look back on the fact that I'm not a fucking lucky man to have a woman like that in my life. And that's part of it, man. There's a lot of people and a lot of women that tuck tail and leave, and they have every right to do that. You know, we fuck things up and we get mixed up with the shit. And she stayed by me, and I got to tip my hat to her, man, because I know 1,000 people that just quit on me already.
Well,
I was
going to say, it's so much easier to quit and just be like, that's it, you know, and to stick by you. That, I can't imagine the work you guys went through and what you've done and she's done. So that's just amazing to hear, because in a business, when you do talk about brotherhood and people that mean so much to you, whether you play with them or not, a lot of times you see guys who are doing this single, they're going through this stuff alone. So it's like, to have her there, that's really special to hear. I'm really happy for you.
Yeah, and the family's most important and things like that. But even our fraternity too, there's some guys out there that are always going to need somewhere to go and somebody to call. And I'll give you my fucking number in a heartbeat.
Like, I think people would love to take it.
I've been there and done that.
Fridge, we want to thank you for joining us. If there's anything you wanted to mention, I know.
Oh, you want to mention somebody's wife's store or something?
Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. There's a couple things I want to mention. Even when we're talking about sobriety and you know, that, like what I'm doing now, my job now is like I work on the front lines with these guys. I work with a detox out of New Jersey. And you know, the CEO, Brooksy, has become a really good friend, and we have like-minded approach to this. And this is a 10% medicine thing and a 90% human thing. And that 90% human thing is if you know and you've been there and you've come back from that, that's what helps these guys. And I never fucking would have thought I'd be working with these people on a daily basis. And I just believe that that's what I'm here to do. So I'm always there for that guy that needs that little shot of hope to get out of that space, because it's fucking can be real dark, and a lot of people fucking die on a daily basis because of this thing. So
yeah,
I'm appreciative of that. And what was the question though?
Well, just any type.
Oh yes,
of,
Dennis Seidenberg was when we were rookies together. I want to tell a story about Dennis.
Okay.
He'll probably get pissed at me.
He's not working with the
Islanders.
This
was my fault. Yes, he is. He is. So this is a very respectful story. If we all know,
yep.
You know,
Lou will come
out. And if it's not, we'll just edit it out.
Yes, and I didn't even want to say his name. What you said it, so that's on you.
Lou's
gonna come after you.
Right now.
Yeah, we. It was funny because it was with Justin Williams and myself and Dennis Seidenberg. He's still married to Rebecca, the same woman. Dennis is still married to, or not Dennis. Justin's still married to Kelly. I'm still married to my wife. And this is our first trip. We were young, you know, having fun. We took the jet skis out. We're in the Bahamas in Nassau. And we went on this little island. We weren't supposed to be there, but we decided to race back. So I was on mine with my wife. Kelly and Justin had their own, and Dennis and Becky had theirs. So we get on, all three of us at the same time, and it's just hit the gas and go, right? So we're like, okay, are you guys ready? You guys ready? And bang, we take off. It's me and Willie. We look back. Dennis is starting where we started yelling, yeah, you can't get going. They couldn't get going at all. We just tucktailed and went. We didn't look back, raced all the way back. We get to shore. We look back on the water. We're like, they must have stopped and messed around or something. Go up to the hotel room, figure they're going to go to their room. 4 hours later, we go down for dinner, and we're like, have you seen Dennis and Becky? Their jet ski broke down. They got stranded on an island. It wasn't even a fucking tree on it. There was just a little branch. 4 hours in the sun, they fucking sat on a stranded island because their thing didn't break down. We didn't even think to look back.
So you pressed gas and didn't even look again.
No, we were racing. I'm not going to look the guy behind me. I'm going that way.
We talked about this brotherhood. What the fuck's going on here?
Yeah, he's also a competitive bastard with his wife trying to win a race.
That's true.
So the way they got off is like, some big yacht with like a beautiful hot tub, like it was a really nice yacht. And they're like, yeah,
Tiger
had a hand, and he's
Bezos.
Like, yeah.
Tiger had some Perkins waitresses on his privacy yacht.
And we seen him later for dinner that night, and they were lobster red, man. We felt so
bad. But now
bad.
Saying that, he's so nice, he probably wasn't even that mad.
No, he's just like, it's okay. He's the nicest guy, man.
Nicest
Dennis
guy
is,
ever.
You know what? He's a consummate professional. This guy trained like a. If I was more like him, I'd still be playing, you know? If every guy was more like them, he'd still be playing.
He still works out like a machine.
He loves it.
Right?
He loves it. And you know what? You got to like guys like that.
Yeah, he was an animal when he played here. I wish I got to bump into him over the weekend.
And you wanted to mention his wife's store that she just started, and that's a quick shout-out for them. What's the name of it?
Yeah, it's Offsides, and Offsides New York. So they've got online. It's a boutique store. She does things by appointment, and I think they got some stuff that they
can get the bull rat Speedo bathing suits.
Yeah, I'm sure you could get some pretty stuff there. She's got some style, Biz, and I know you're one of those guys that likes to wear nice shoes and stuff. So
yeah,
hit her up.
Here are my Birkenstocks.
Offsides New York
socks and Birkenstocks on.
Yeah.
Well, Fridge, thank you so much. Just a great career and a great guy, and I think everyone's gonna really love listening to this.
Yeah,
so
it was raw. Thank you.
Good stuff.
Big thanks to Todd Fedora for joining us. Not only did he join us for the show, he schlepped all the way up here from New Jersey with his buddy Dennis Seidenberg. They took a ride up, so big thanks for him for coming all the way up, man. I mean, not everybody is willing to drive 4 hours to come on the show.
We would have got Seidenberg on, but he works for the Islanders, and there's
no chance.
Chicken dick's chance. Yeah. Lou's going to let him But hey, good for him. He's got a great job. I think he's doing player development.
Yep. Where I think he helps also guys when they're coming back from injury, skate, get back into shape. He's a tank.
He's
still
a tank. He is a unit. He looks like a guy who's like a sergeant in the army.
Yeah.
Or he does hardcore parkour. And what's the other one? The
or
the one where they're doing all those exercises all the time and lifting weights and throwing weights around.
CrossFit. Like
CrossFit.
CrossFit. If you do CrossFit, you're nuts. Yeah. But God bless you.
Yeah.
CrossFit people. My neck. They do CrossFit too.
My back. My pussy and my crack.
Have you ever heard this?
Witt's been complaining about his fucking neck since I got here.
No, I got a rib out. My body's such a mess. Do you know I was checking in? Actually, okay. So I was checking into a hotel in Moscow. And there, or it was somewhere in Russia. I don't know exact the city. And it was the song in the lobby playing like lightly was my neck, my back,
lick my pussy, yeah, but, and my
or
crack.
Or it was it might have been put it in my mouth.
Oh yeah, put it.
It was one of those two. Corey Emerton was there. He'll back this up.
I like
that.
That was the
lobby music.
Oh yeah,
imagine.
It's a great segue though. Now that you mention it, boys, because most guys have tried different ways to last longer.
Roman.
But thinking about cup champs doesn't always work. The folks at Roman, an online men's health company, are changing the game with Roman Swipes, the secret to longer-lasting sex. Roman Swipes are a clinically proven way to last longer in bed. They're effective, easy to use, fast-acting, and the best part, they don't require a prescription, so you don't have to go into CVS and have your name called out and have people look at you and say, ah, he can't keep up over there. You don't have to worry about that stuff.
Hey, I go quick.
Yeah, not
aisle
Roman.
7.
Roman can ship swipes to you in discreet, unmarked packaging, and each swipes packet is small enough to hide in your wallet for whenever you need it. They're super easy to use. You just take the swipes out of the packet, swipe it on, let it dry, and you're good to go. That's it. So go to GetRoman.com/chicklets. You can get your first month of swipes for just $5 when you choose a monthly plan. That's GetRoman.com/chicklets.
Did they add the good to go, or did you do that?
That's my homage to Boston's Bobby Brown. Yeah, the old Bobby Brown song. You know, probably like, which Bobby Brown?
I know who Bobby Brown is, but okay. I was thinking about my next question. See, my brain was going somewhere else because you mentioned today that because we were talking about Boston, the town had something special happen to it today. You sent us.
Oh, RA, I have to bring
so
this
we're
going to
open. We're going to open up the whole trip with the fact that I was brainwashed and had to watch the town four times in a row with their shackled
with
in with my eyes
open.
Open,
clockwork, RA.
And now we're going to end it. So what was the story?
The story is he sent a tweet out to us of there's an oral history that came out because it's 10 years since the town. And now my only thing, I have no offense because I know you're starting it. The town does not deserve an oral history. Like, it was a very decent
movie. Well, I was intrigued by it. That's why I asked
him. Did you think it was an unreal movie, RA? Or did you even kind of admit it's a little...
No, I honestly, when I saw it, I went in, I wouldn't say skeptical. I went in curious because, yeah, it's about your hometown and there's a potential that it could get screwed up real bad. But when I come out of it, I was like impressed with it. I thought it was really a well done movie. It was very, I mean, Affleck did a great job with it. And obviously I'm biased. I'm in it. It's my hometown. But I really thought it was a great movie. I thought it was very well done.
So you're basically acting like they're acting like a Shawshank Redemption.
Yes, yes. It's like, okay. I think oral histories for movies is like The Godfather Part 2 oral history.
Well, that's
history.
A good...
Problem Child oral history. You ever seen that movie? The redheaded sick kid.
Oh, yeah.
The movie's unreal.
Yeah.
But I was just like, oral history for the town.
Okay, well, that's a good question for our audience. Do you think that the town is worthy of an oral
Let's
history?
Let's put a poll up. Is the town worthy of an oral history?
Like, well, what's the standard for an oral history? I mean, I've seen
oral
histories all... about anything online. All you do is get
people. I've only seen it about like very legendary things. Like, remember you sent me the one on
Boogie Nights?
Caddyshack,
yeah.
Boogie Nights. There was one.
All right, I didn't even know what the fucking oral history was.
I mean,
so this is all
business like oral?
There are oral histories on fucking 5-year-old commercials. I think it's a 10-year anniversary, and that's the biggest trigger to write about anything on the internet these days.
Also, in the acting field, we need to talk about the fact that Jim Carrey is going to be playing Joe Biden in this upcoming season of SNL. Are they considered seasons?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I think Jim Carrey is funny, and I think he's going to fucking nail it. And that's a name that would draw me back into watching Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think if maybe the hologram of John Belushi might be the only thing to get me watching that show again. And listen, I watched it from the get-go. I've always liked it. I haven't swayed away for political reasons. I just don't think... The show just doesn't make me laugh anymore like it used to.
That's why I'm hoping Jim Carrey's injection does.
Yeah, I mean, it's still... That's only one guy, only one character. I mean, what it is that... Those people write their own sketches, whatever you want to call
them. There's no writers for that show?
Well, the performers. There are other writers who aren't performers, but how you get on that show is you write your own shit. And the good stuff, well, back in the day, rose to the top. It's a show, like I said, I just don't find it funny anymore. I wish I did. I grew up on it. It's one of the all-time classic shows. But even that, Jim Carrey is Biden. It's like, you know, as much as I like Jim Carrey and his work, I don't know.
Fair enough.
I just dunked on you.
I know.
How about the block in that fucking NBA game? That was the most amazing block I've ever seen in my life. Shouting out basketball. Last night, Jason Tatum went to slam. I think he was trying to dunk. Yeah. He was trying to dunk home the tying, like, 4 3 seconds left. They're down two. Drives the lane. Listen to me describe hoop. Goes up. Boom. Like windmill. This dude put his fingers. He must have the strongest, longest fingers. He must be unbelievable at getting girls going. And he blocked this, like, 90-mile-an-hour dunk. I'm serious.
Dude.
I swear to God, it's the best block I've ever seen in my life.
It's insane.
Well, yeah, you're fucking
besides
selling it.
Old girl's friend. Like, you used to be wheeling a girl and her friend would just, like, block
yeah,
you.
Yeah, Heisman. Get out of my
yeah, fucking... I don't know if the picture to it. I don't know if you start like the guy's hands practically bent into the rim.
Yeah,
I don't know
it's
how,
nuts.
I don't know how it, that dunked
in. Double jointed.
Definitely one of the best blocks ever.
So you're going to be on TNT next. You're going to be getting joined the panel the way you're describing these basketball.
If I play golf,
you could make anything sound interesting. But I want to hear this golf story.
Well, oh yeah. So okay, go ahead.
Oh
Ryan.
No. So, oh, I just had a couple other news items before.
Oh okay. Yeah, we'll wait before. For that.
Yeah. No, we usually finish with the golf.
Sure.
Big news in Washington. They named Peter Laviolette their coach.
Oh, yeah.
It's believed to be a 3-year deal. He's still under contract with the Preds for next season for making $2.5 million, but I guess the Caps are going to cover that as part of the deal.
Oh, nice of them.
Also, the Flames removed the interim tag from Jeff Ward, so he's going to be the head coach in Calgary. He signed a 2-year deal, so he's probably going to be celebrating with some nice Budweiser up in Canada, eh, Biz?
Oh, here we go, baby. I got the ad read. Now, before I start reading,
No!
Wait, I don't need that. Now, no one.
You're nervous, anxiety.
You're kind of being like me on the golf course, bad teammate guy right now. Okay, yeah, I'm going to start reading this and I'm going to explain exactly what we got going after. And this is in quotation. Time to stop your whining because sports is back. I'm talking all the sports. The NFL is back. The Stanley Cup Finals are on. Not a bad time to be a sports fan. Our close friends at Budweiser and I are doing something epic in honor of the greatest month of sports ever. We want to pay you to take a vacation to just watch sports. We call it the Bud Bubble, an amazing place for you and your buds to bubble up and watch sports all day, every day, free from distractions, no work, no dogs, no responsibilities. This place is sick. It's got a soaking tub, your own gym, a screening room where sports will be on 24/7, a personal chef. Fuck, I might even shove you in there, Whit. You'd be fucking laughing. And all the NHL, NFL, and baby Blue Jay swag you can imagine. All dedicated to helping you watch sports with your buds. And on top of it all, you'll be paid cold, hard cash. That's right. You and your friends are going to get paid to hang out and watch sports. Not a big deal. Get your buds and go to Budweiser.ca/BudBubble now to see how you can get into the Bud Bubble.
You should see how they spelt cold hard cash so that he would read it cold hard cash.
No, I actually ad-libbed that because it said cold hard moolah and it registered to my brain before I read it and I switched it. At the fucking goal line, good audible job. In an ad read.
Get out of here, you breaths.
Is it bad?
Yeah. Right. Terry.
Well, hey, guys, I this is with Budweiser, obviously. I think it's a cool concept, very similar to that CHO thing I did. And we've been promoting it all over our social channels, including mine. So check it out, and you get paid to hang out with some buddies in your own little sports bubble and, you know, drink some buds.
Do you promote stuff on your social channel?
Shut the fuck up. How about that ad read, though?
That
come
was
on,
really
stick
good.
Tabs?
No, you actually just read as well as I've ever seen you do. I think I know what you did during quarantine, Hooked on Phonics.
Yeah, no free
good
ads.
Stuff. So, what
okay,
the,
yeah, quick yeah. story. We'll wrap it up. This story's been a little overblown now. It's but... It involves Wingfoot, and that's where this week's U.S. Open is being played. It's like It's an amazing course, two courses, but one of them, the West Course, is where they play the U.S. Opens. Now, it just crushes guys, right? It's the hardest course in the world, some people say. So I'm going to leave the names out of the story because, you know, I don't want anyone to be offended or anything. But I got two buddies. One of them's a member at Wingfoot. These two buddies, they're married to sisters, right? So these two friends of mine, their father-in-law, their wife's father, is a legend. Unbelievable golfer, hilarious guy. So he goes for a round at Wingfoot, where the U.S. Open just crushes pro golfers. And he gets to the third hole. And the third hole at Wingfoot is this week, I think it's playing 240, par 3, right? It's crushing. Jesus. It can kill you. I don't know what it played in 1959, but that year, Billy Casper won the U.S. Open at Wingfoot. A legend, Billy Casper, Hall of Famer. And so when my friend's father-in-law gets up to the third hole, the caddies are telling him, yeah. So what happened here in the 59 U.S. Open is that Billy Casper laid up every single time he played and made par all four rounds. So he would lay up short of the green, and then he'd hit a wedge on, and he buried the putt. He's like, I'm not trying to hit an unbelievably perfect shot and end up making double bogey. I'll just lay up, and worst case, I make bogey. Well, he made par all four times. So they tell my friend's father-in-law the story, and he's like, oh, cool. Well, this guy's sick at golf. He gets up there and hits an absolute fucking bullet right at the pin. Bink, bink, in. Hole in one. Third hole. Toughest par three on the course. What does this legend proceed to do? Running down the fairway screaming, Billy Casper can suck my dick. So, all respect to Billy Casper. I think Billy Casper's thought of as a hero and a legend in the moment. Golf. But to be told that this Hall of Famer laid up every round and then to ace it,
yeah,
I think that if I had been there, I would have been crying laughing. So that's a good Wingfoot story. But I'll say right now, I've played this course. It should be a great week, and there'll be some really high scores.
We should play a sandbagger there.
I don't think they'd ever let us do that. But if they did, we would get murdered.
I don't miss
fairways. But I'm
looking
forward to watching it. So,
well, that was great. Great short golf talk. I'm sure the fans will love that.
All right. Sounds good.
All right, gang. That wraps up another episode. Everybody have a fantastic weekend, and we'll catch you back here Monday with some the latest results. As always, we'd like to thank our Dynamite sponsors here on Spit and Chicklets. Big thanks to everybody at New Amsterdam Vodka and Pink Whitney. Huge thanks to everybody over at Thursday Boots. Super comfy. Love that leather smell. Big thanks to everybody over at Simply Safe for keeping everybody safe during these crazy times. Huge thanks to our friends at Roman for taking care of the fellas out there. And big thanks to everybody at Bud Canada. Have a great week, everybody.
On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again. The life I love is making music with my friends. I can't wait to get on the road again.